Hi there. Okay. Hi there. Everything sound okay?
Yes.
Good. Okay. Always the great dilemma. And the sound is so much better than it used to be, but still not perfect.
Yeah.
Well, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. It's we're about to start 5 days of rain here. So I think we just had the last sunshine for a while.
Oh, man.
But since I'm just back from Phoenix, where it was 104 degrees the whole time, I'm actually totally happy. I'm just like, yes, let's never go back there again.
Yeah.
So is it beautiful there? Are you just like in beautiful warm sunshine?
Pretty much.
I have clients down in the Bay Area, and if you ask them, well, how's the weather? They say, oh, just perfect as always. It's kind of boring. So, is Linnell in your office or is she actually a
Linnell
community?
is with one of our sub-grantees,
Oh,
HQ.
great. Well, welcome, Linnell. Hopefully, you will speak up during the webinar. It makes it so much more interesting when people talk about what they're doing. Well, welcome everybody. I always appreciate people who join early. It just kind of gives us a nice head start.
CSBG grant. Okay, I might have to grab something across the walkway and get so hungry. Need to establish hours with him. Friday. Oh, especially I think Friday 12.
Oh, are you guys talking to each other?
Oh, no. Are you in the
Oh, yeah.
meeting tonight?
Oh, okay.
Well, Courtney, if I can share, I can go ahead and put the cover slide up. But
I think it was get kids
this is like this.
Yeah.
Okay, we got it now. And this is where I always have to ask you, does that look right?
Yes.
Good. Okay. Well, we're ready to rock and roll. So it looks like a typical after lunch or lunchtime. Not everybody is right here, so that's okay. Okay, we've got more people. I just spotted them.
All right, let's get this started.
Okay.
Good morning, everybody. We have our uniform guidance training today with Kay Soul. Please feel free to unmute yourself at any point in the training to ask questions or ask comments, questions, concerns. Otherwise, I will be monitoring the chat to see if there are any questions that come up, and I can ask those questions at the time. Otherwise, I will leave it to Kay Soul to get us
Okay,
started.
great. Well, thank you, Courtney. And it's been great working with Courtney to get this together. And I just want to emphasize what she just said, that it is totally helpful if you ask questions or actually make comments. Because, some of the things that we're going to be talking about, there are different interpretations. And you may be handling a problem area that I talk about. You may be handling it differently. And people will be interested in that. So please plan to share that information. And yeah, either with just, unmute and say, wait, I want to ask a question or say something, or through the chat and Courtney will be watching. And I think we've timed this so that there is plenty of time throughout to answer questions and still have some time at the end just for any final reflections that you might have. And as you know, this is the first part of a two-part training. And so I think we'll get through all of part one and preview what we're going to do next week in part two. And I think Courtney's recording this, which is always a great idea, because then if there's someone else in your agency that you would like to talk to about any of these concepts, you can actually show them the recording and it can help get a discussion going. You're going to see it once we dive into this topic that one of the really frustrating things about the uniform guidance, these rules for managing federal funds, is that they use a lot of terminology that people use the same word to describe two different things, and they use two different words to describe the same thing. And so often, after a long, painful discussion, we realize, well, we're not actually talking about the same thing at all. And one thing I just saw the other day in my email is someone has created a set of flashcards for the acronyms that just load into this. So if you want to talk about the flashcards, we can do that at the end. I'm not sure anybody is quite brave enough to track, to actually tackle a set of flashcards, but I thought it was pretty interesting. Okay, so where I want to start, I think you've read a little bit about me. I'm actually based in Oregon, but I travel all over the country working with community action agencies, primarily around financial management and compliance with the uniform guidance and the other federal regulations. I have a big interest in the financial sustainability of community action agencies, so that's another theme. But what I want to do first is find out who you are and who's here. And so if you could chat in your this is your total identity, but your identity in relation to this event. Do I have some executive directors and do I have some CFOs or fiscal directors? Do I have some other fiscal staff, not the director? I sometimes have program managers, and that is really interesting because they sometimes ask the best questions. And then I have an other category. And Courtney, I'm not actually seeing the chat right now. So is anybody answering? And what kind of distribution are you getting?
No responses
No
yet.
response.
Oh, there we go.
Thank
We
you.
have a Chief Operating Officer, Director of Information Services, Deputy Director, Fiscal,
Any
Director of Planning,
Okay, that's a good one.
Weatherization Program Coordinator,
Oh, my sympathy.
Executive Director.
That's
Executive
pretty.
assistant.
Okay. Well, thank you to those of you who did type it in. That really helps me. And I think it helps everybody to understand that this is a pretty diverse audience in terms of people with different backgrounds. Now, I didn't plan to ask you how many of you have been to more trainings on the uniform guidance than you could ever imagine, but I expect that we have a range there too. Everything from people who are pretty new to this whole world and maybe have learned a lot about it, but have never gone to a formal training. training to people who could actually present this training because they have so much understanding of the uniform guidance. So that's actually helpful in terms of making the webinar work well, especially if people who are newer are willing to ask questions, and especially if the people who've been around for a while and really know a lot about this are willing to share the things, the tips that they've learned over the years. That makes it really interesting. So what are we going to talk about? Well, in part one, I do have some updates on the uniform guidance, and some of you understand that this set of federal rules first got announced and implemented in 2014, and we've had several revisions, but we're going to talk about the latest revision, which was just released a week ago, and I think that's worth spending a little time talking about. That latest revision is a proposed revision, hasn't been adopted. So we're going to talk about the uniform guidance and the various updates and what these updates have changed and how it's made it different, and then we're going to go into one of the I would say one of the most frequently confused aspects of the uniform guidance, which is the distinction between pass-through entities. That's like your state government that gets federal money and passes it through to you, and then they pass it through to some sub-recipients. That's what community action agencies usually are. But they may also pass money through to contractors. And one of the things we're going to talk about is whether you, as a sub-recipient, may also be functioning as a pass-through. And I find that is pretty common in community action, particularly in community action agencies that serve large rural areas, big territories. So we're going to talk about that. Then we're going to talk about procurement, which I have to admit is one of my least favorite subjects because it just frustrates people so much. And while the rules have gotten a little bit simpler as we've gone through the various revisions, it's still irritating, I guess is what I would say. So we're going to talk about that. We're not going to go in super depth, but I can help you find resources if you want to go a little further with that. Now, what we are going to spend a lot of time on, because in many ways, this is the part that matters the most in terms of how you as a subrecipient can actually be entitled to recover or claim the various costs that you incur to do your various programs. And this concept of cost principles and allowability and cost allocation, although this is coming from a set of federal rules, it is very often mirrored in the requirements that a state contract, a state agreement that only has state money has, or other agreements that you have that may be a mix of state and federal money. We're going to talk about these cost principles and what they really mean in terms of how you are going to be able to justify claiming all the costs that you have in order to do these various programs. And finally, we're going to talk about the most painful of these questions, which is how do I go about recovering or getting to charge my agency-wide administrative costs? Because we all have them. We all have accounting systems. We all have boards of directors. We all have overall oversight. And unfortunately, these federal rules are very focused on being sure that we don't overstate those costs in order to claim them and justify charging them. So we're going to get started on that topic today, and then we're going to go much more in depth in the second session. So that's my overall plan. And there really is time for people to ask questions about other things they've heard or that they're concerned about. So if you'll kind of follow along and start with questions about these topics, we can branch out. So, you know, I have a goal for this workshop, and it is that a lot of people, they come to these webinars and they're really kind of beat. And so that's the before. And my hope is that after we talk about all this stuff, you're going to feel more like this, sort of blissed out is what I would say. It's just like, I've got it. I know what to do. I can make this work. So that's my hope, that that will be the takeaway rather than continuing in the before picture. All right, so quick history, very quick history of the uniform guidance. Well, first of all, the uniform guidance is actually in the Code of Federal Regulations. It's a big section. It's 2 CFR Part 200. You can look it up and it's available online. And what they did back in 2014 is there was a big movement to say this is really making everybody crazy to have different circulars for different types of nonprofits. And the rules were actually different in those different circulars. And people said, this is just wild. And also, different agreements would cite different rules. So the idea was uniformity, hence the uniform guidance. Now, as we're going to learn, it didn't quite turn out that way. They improved the consistency, they made progress towards uniformity, but it is still not uniform across all federal programs that you may be participating in. And that's because these very specific federal programs like weatherization, we've got a weatherization director here, like Head Start, like LIHEAP, like CSBG, all of these very specific federal programs have their own specific section in the Code of Federal Regulations. And if Congress puts specific rules for that type of funding into the statute when the statute was adopted, then those rules override what's in the uniform guidance. Now, over the years since 2014, a lot of progress has been made to get the various federal agencies with these different programs to bring their rules into conformity with the uniform guidance. But it's not 100%. And there's kind of two sets of exceptions that we should call out. One is the most common statutory difference is that the statute for a particular program like Head Start or LIHEAP has an administrative cap, and it says you can't spend more than X percent of the money on administrative costs. That isn't in the uniform guidance, and if you have several of those grants, you probably have several different administrative caps that you're dealing with. So that is not uniform. The other way that it's not uniform fully is that, as you know, grants like CSBG are block grants, and that means that the funds flow to the states. And the states have a lot of discretion in how they treat those funds. And so there are some areas where there's no uniformity because the different states do different things. But fortunately, the area that we're going to spend a lot of time on, which is the cost principles, what can you charge? That is an area that even in a block grant like CSBG, you do have to follow the uniform guidance. And that makes things a little bit simpler. Well, so they passed this thing and implemented it in 2014. There was a lot of hubbub about it. Everybody kind of got used to it. And then in 2020, they had revisions. I would say the revisions were not earth-shaking. They actually clarified some things that were not clear in the original version and made a few changes. The bigger changes came in 2024, and we are going to spend some time talking about those because I just want to be sure everybody knows what changed in 2024. And I think most people felt like those changes were pretty positive for nonprofit organizations that were trying to manage multiple federal grants. Well, they also in the beginning of 2025, they revived this organization called the Council on Federal Financial Assistance, or CFFA. And this body had been very helpful back in 2014 interpreting the uniform guidance, and they would publish answers to commonly asked questions, frequently asked questions, very helpful. Well, so they kind of got them back into action in 25. It's not quite as comprehensive as it was in 2014, but if you have questions, that is definitely a place to go. Now, I guess bad news, good news is that last Friday, the Office of Management and Budget, that's the federal organ ed agency, it's actually part of the executive department, they published proposed revisions to the uniform guidance. And they published these proposed revisions on a very fast timeline. And they have given us 45 days to comment. That means that by July 13th, comment period closes. So if you have something to say about it, you got to say it quickly. And I actually think it works best if state associations or national associations comment, because they're going to get a lot of comments and they're probably going to pay more attention to those group comments. They are also on an accelerated timeline and they are saying that they plan to take the final input July 13th, process it, think about it, and actually make any revisions that they're going to make in time to make the effective date for the new rules be October 1, 26. Now that is moving very, very fast. And all of us just need to get ready for that. And, I'll just say a couple of words about the changes that I think are of most interest to community action. And then you can, dig in and read it and see what you think. A lot of the changes are related to the issue of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And you've already had executive orders that are, don't even think it, basically, is the theme of those executive orders. And this new revised version of the uniform guidance just spells it all out exactly how you can't do that, you mustn't do that, not with federal money. So I'm sure there are going to be challenges, but that's in there. Then they got through that whole part and they got to a more disturbing part to me, which is they said that although in some of these federal award programs, there are provisions for advisory committees or expert panels that would advise the federal agencies on which proposals might be most effective. They made it clear that the federal agency does not have to listen to what those advisory panels say, and they do not have to justify why they are making decisions that would be contrary to what those panels say. Now, I don't think a lot of community action agencies are involved with sources where these panels have played a huge role, but if you are, that's something to know. More disturbing is there's a clarification in the proposed revisions that says, basically, if the federal agency that made the award to you, if you were a direct recipient, or suppose they made the award to the state of Hawaii and the state of Hawaii turned around and sub-awarded funds to you, if the federal agency perceives that there has been something going on with either a recipient or a subrecipient that is contrary to the executive orders that they talk about earlier, which are primarily DEI issues, but other issues too, they are able to move immediately to terminate the grant. So a lot of the prior protections that people had, that you had to be given notice, there had to be reasons for termination, you had an opportunity to respond. A lot of those protections appear to be being removed. Now, I did say, and I'll tell you one more thing that may concern you. You might say, well, that's the least of my troubles. They did go back to saying that any money that you might want to spend on memberships in associations, like, if you have a Hawaii Community Action Association, or if maybe you belong to CAPLA, if you want to spend money on associations, you have to have prior approval from the federal source. Similarly, if you want to pay for training, you have to have prior approval. Well, this in the past was a big red tape bogged down because the agencies couldn't move very quickly to respond to these requests. Now, they are saying really clearly that if you put the specific association you want to be a member of and the specific training you want to attend, if you put that into your application and into the budget and you justify it in the budget justification and your application is approved, your budget is approved, that constitutes prior approval. So I think the grant writers in our group are probably going to start putting a lot more detail into the proposals to just avoid the bog down of waiting for approval after the fact. Now, I said there was a little bit of good news in the proposed revisions, and that is that although many people thought they were going to look at the question of indirect cost and try to redefine indirect costs, and some of you may get communication from the Department of Energy, and you may have read Some of their, well, they were not proposals, they were declarations of changing things last fall in September. Now they had to back down, there are a bunch of court cases, and so they withdrew these new rules. But those new rules had a completely different definition of indirect costs than is in the uniform guidance or has ever been traditional in federal funding. So a lot of us were very worried that we would see that in the proposed revisions, that it, you know, they couldn't get it through just by dropping it on to all the recipients and subrecipients. They would put it in the revised uniform guidance. They did not, and they actually say that they're not considering indirect costs at this time. Well, who knows when they might consider it, but at least they're not considering it right now. So if I've said enough to make you sort of like, geez, I'm not very happy about what you've said, you might want to send in a comment, but you got to do it fast because the comment period closes July 13th. And I just want to be really clear with everyone, all that stuff that I just talked about, that is proposed. That is not the rule right now. And we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about what the rules are now, not what is being proposed, because we don't know what will happen when that proposal, you know, when they get comments and either decide to revise it or not. Okay. Did someone maybe say something? That would be wonderful. Maybe not. Okay, I'm going to keep going, but you can also use that raise your hand if I'm not hearing you, so I'm not stopping when you're saying, what about? Okay, so, you know, here's the basics. You can look up the uniform guidance. It's free to you. Most people bookmark it on their computer so they can find it. And, you know, the whole point of it is this is guidance on how to manage federal funds. It replaced all the different circulars that OMB had put out there, but it can't override statutory provisions. So in 2024, the big changes were, and this is the one I think most community action agencies have the greatest interest in, within the uniform guidance, there is this concept of a de minimis rate. And what that is it's permission to charge for your agency-wide administrative cost and certain other shared or indirect costs. Back in the 2014 version, everybody was given permission to charge 10% of their grant for these indirect costs. Now in 2024, they raised that to 15%. Now, the thing that catches people up is it is not 15% of the total grant. It is 15% of a very particularly defined amount, which is called the modified total direct cost base. And we are going to talk about that today because that is a really important concept. And why I think it matters to community action is I am finding many community action agencies that either never had a negotiated indirect cost rate, and those that did have a negotiated rate, both kinds are saying, you know, the de minimis rate might be better for us than what we had before. So we are seeing community action agencies evaluate whether this would be a good change or not. And we'll talk a little bit about, well, what would you do? How would you do that evaluation? So that was a big deal to a lot of nonprofit organizations. Now, the other thing that they clarified was who can use this de minimis rate. And in the original uniform guidance, they said, well, anybody, any organization, as long as they do not have a currently negotiated indirect cost rate, or they have never had a negotiated indirect cost rate. Well, it turned out that the federal government has no record.
Oh, it's Courtney next up. Oh my God, I better clap on.
Somebody's on the HCE.
Yeah.
Oh, that's me then.
So you are you?
It gotta be you.
Are you gonna mute it?
Somebody's here, though.
Okay.
Oh, actually, it was Greg because I saw him chat inside here.
So, are we okay to go?
You went downstairs yet?
No, why?
Sharon was hissy today with Renee.
Well, yesterday, I went down there. Well, I was sitting in my office.
Tarasen called him. Hi, Tara. Thank you.
What?
There we go. Okay, thank you. So what they, you know, it turned out that people would say, well, did my agency used to have a negotiated indirect cost rate? And no one could say. And so in the 2024 revisions, they said, forget it. Anybody can have the use of the indirect, the de minimis rate, unless they are a state or local government that has more than $35 million in federal funds. And I don't think that's any of the sub-recipient community action agencies here, because it applies only to state and local government. There could be counties that might have more than $35 million in federal dollars, and they cannot use the de minimis rate. The other who can't use it is you have to wrap up the use of an existing negotiated rate before you can start using the de minimis rate. So it's something to think about. Now, another change that doesn't seem to have affected very many people is there's been always a requirement that you have a single audit for if you receive and expend federal funds. And it was originally that if you had 500,000 in federal funds, then it went to 750. Now in the 24 revisions, it's $1 million. So if you expended $1 million in federal funds, combining money you got directly from the federal government, like Head Start, and money you got through a pass-through, like the state of Hawaii for CSBG, combine those numbers. If it added up to $1 million expended in your fiscal year, you got to have the single audit. So that was a little expansion. They're trying to get the equivalent of indexing happening here. Now, the other thing they did was to say our previous definition of how much you could spend on an item before you had to consider it to be equipment or a capitalized asset, and how little, can you call it a supply? Used to be $5,000, now it's $10,000. You can buy something up to $10,000 and consider it to be a supply, even if it's going to last more than a year. Now, the catch on that one is it's your fiscal policies and procedures that matter. So if you still have a $5,000 limit, then your limit is $5,000, regardless of what the uniform guidance says, until you change it. It's always your rules that govern. Now, the other thing that they made clearer was in the procurement, when we buy things. There, earlier in the uniform guidance, there's a lot of confusion about they would name these numbers. Well, if you're going to spend more than $10,000 on something, treat it this way. But it wasn't clear whether there was any inflation to those numbers. And sometimes they would make it sound like you should actually go look in the FAR, the federal acquisition requirements. And this time they said, yes, that's exactly right. We're not going to spell out dollar limits for the different kinds of procurements. When we talk about these different categories and you want to know what's the maximum amount that we can spend under that category, go look it up in the FAR because that will be up to date and that's going to be the right information. And the FAR is online too. It's just
Yeah.
a, nobody should be buying sleeping pills. That is a real snore, even more than the uniform guidance. Okay, there's more. That's not all. They tried in 2024 to reduce the number of times where you had to get prior approval. But in this proposed revision, they're saying, no, we want more prior approval for two specific kinds of things. And again, this hasn't been adopted yet, but this is what they're proposing. They want prior approval for joining an association, the cost of joining an association, and for training, sending someone to a training. That's the proposed rule right now. Those are both in the thing that was in 24 to try and streamline things and not have so much prior approval. They did clarify the rules for defining direct cost, and we're going to talk about that because it seems obvious, but as it turned out, it's not obvious. And so they made it clearer what they were talking about. Now, when you get down to the lower left-hand side, this is a technicality, and we are going to look at the modified total direct cost rules to understand this technicality. But those of you who are using the de minimis rate probably already know that there is a provision that says you can't charge the de minimis rate on any amount that you have given to another organization as a sub-award other than the first $50,000. So we'll go through what are they talking about and why did it go from 25,000 to 50,000. And then they kind of tinkered with these geographic preferences in procurement, and they've kind of done away with them again. That's gone in and out over the years. Okay, well, those are the changes, and we're only going to talk about a couple of them because they're really relevant in community action. This is just an overview. Those of you who've been around for a while know that the Uniform Guidance has multiple sections where you have to learn where to go to find what you're trying to find out. So the places that I go most often are to subpart E, the cost principles. That's where a lot of the action really is for nonprofit organizations. What can you charge to a federal award? That's what that's all about. And they have now developed these appendices, and there's a separate one for state and federal governments, as opposed to nonprofits, as opposed to institutions of higher education. So it's a little clearer what they're talking about. But this is the overall context. And if you're fairly new to this system, I think this is one of the things that is initially kind of hard to grasp. And the reason it's hard to grasp is people use terminology in a very unclear way. So here's the big picture. We got a federal agency, say HHS or Department of Energy or Department of Labor. We got a federal agency. They decide to award funds to a recipient. And that's just a term for the entity that they're giving money to carry out a program. Now, in many cases, the entity that they're giving the money to, they are treating as a pass-through entity. And by that, they mean, yes, we're giving the state of Hawaii a bunch of money from our CSBG allocations, but no, we don't think the state is going to directly spend all that money. They are going to pass it through or sub-award it to sub-recipients like the community action agencies. So that sounds simple enough. And the general rule is that whether you are a recipient or a sub-recipient, you have to follow these uniform guidance rules and the other federal regulations for the particular kind of money you're getting. But what makes this confusing is that the Uniform Guidance makes a big distinction between entities that are sub-recipients and entities that are contractors. And we used to call these contractors vendors. So some people still call them vendor contractors. And why, who cares? What difference does it make, the difference between these two? And the answer to that is that all these federal rules, the Uniform Guidance and the other things in the Code of Federal Regulations, they apply to sub-recipients and they don't apply to contractors. So it really matters to know when you get an agreement, are you being treated as a sub-recipient or are you being treated as a contractor? And what makes it hard is that many times the words used in the agreement, it might even be across the top of the agreement, it might say contract. But it may not be a contract. It may be a sub-recipient agreement. And so we've got to be sure that anytime we get new funds from the feds directly or from a pass-through entity, we have correctly determined what is this? And sometimes it's just not clear. You read it and you really can't tell, and you just have to call up the entity that gave the money to you and say, is this a sub-recipient agreement or is this a contract? There's a lot of pitfalls here, and we're going to talk about some of them. But really, it comes down to you need to read these agreements, and if there's stuff in there that is unclear, call them up and ask them. And then I always confirm what I'm told in an email. And I will say in the email, now, I really appreciated your help, and this is what I understand. Please confirm whether I have correctly understood what you told me about this question. And I repeat the question, because sometimes it just isn't clear. So, this is the process that I think a lot of us use every time we get a new funding agreement, even if it's from a funder we've had many times before, because they change things in the agreements. We get the agreement. We hopefully have already reviewed the requirements that are going to be in that agreement before we applied for the money. It's a little too late after it's been awarded to us and we discovered that there's some requirements that we're going to have trouble meeting. So we're going to review the funding source requirements before we apply. And then after we're chosen, after we're awarded the money, we're going to review the award agreement or the contract carefully. And I usually set up a master file, and this is the file on this particular agreement. And what I put in there is I start with the ALN number. Now, that is in every agreement if it is a subrecipient agreement. It may not be in an agreement that is a contract. Some of us have been around long enough that we know that we used to call this the CFDA number. It's just a numbering system for all these federal awards. We have to put it on our schedule of federal expenditures that we put in our single audit. So you need to find it out. And occasionally I see a subrecipient agreement where the AL number and number is not specified. And that's an example of when you call them up and say, where did this money come from? What is the ALN number? And then you confirm it by email because it's going to be important to know. Okay, we got to have the ALN number and we got to know whether the uniform guidance applies. And it's in agreements like the CSBG agreement that is, one of these block grant agreements that we're going to see that some parts of the uniform guidance apply and some parts don't apply. So we've got to read the agreement carefully. And I usually create a matrix for each award. I set of columns on a spreadsheet where I go through and I read the award and then I mark off all the things that we're required to do. And some of you are pretty familiar, weatherization people are pretty familiar with the Buy America, Build America requirements about what things we can buy and what companies are banned from us buying from them. And so we need to know which of our federal agreements can, that's called BABA, perfect, I think, which ones are subject to BABA, and which ones are subject to the Davis-Bacon Labor Act. That's going to be in the agreement, and you need to know because you'll have to do some record keeping to be sure you comply. And then this is what's really a pain is okay, you read all this stuff in all your agreements, you made your matrix, you understand what these different federal agreements require you to do. And maybe you read in one agreement that they've moved to the $10,000 threshold for what can be capitalized. Well, now we got to go back and review our own policies and decide, are we going to mirror that? Are we going to use the same rules as the feds did? Or are we going to stick to what we had before? Because when we have an independent audit done of our records, our auditor is going to judge us against what was in our policies, not what's in the federal rules. And the general rule is we can be more conservative or we can use lower thresholds than these federal thresholds. We can't use higher ones. We can't go higher. So this will keep somebody busy. And now, just to kind of summarize what we're saying about this pass-through relationship. The state agencies are considered recipients of federal dollars. They're also generally considered pass-through entities, which means they can make awards to sub-recipients. Both recipients, that's the state, and the sub-recipients, that's you, the Community Action Agency, are required to follow the uniform guidance rules. Everybody has to follow the rules. And the thing is that the recipients, like in your case, the state, they're responsible for what the subrecipients do. So if I'm a state recipient and I make a subaward to a nonprofit subrecipient and they don't follow the rules in the uniform guidance, it's me, the state, that is going to be in trouble with the feds. Well, there'll also be plenty of trouble to go around, but the key thing here is this: the feds are going to hold the recipient responsible. Now, nonprofits like community action agencies or even public community action agencies, local government, can also serve as pass-through entities. And that would mean that you have subrecipients. And so the thing to remember there is if your subrecipients, which are often small organizations, if they are incapable of following these rules, you are going to be held responsible for whatever mistakes they make. In community action, I most often see the use of subrecipient agreements when a community action agency has a very large territory that they're trying to serve. They can't get staff out into the farther areas. So they find a local organization to do some part of their program and they give them a subrecipient agreement. But what the rules are is before you do that, you're supposed to have done a risk assessment. Do you think they can manage funds in accord with the federal rules? That's the big question. And if you think, well, gee, they don't even have an accounting system. I'm not sure how they're going to do that. Then you have to come up with some mitigating ways that you're going to make it work, so that you can be sure that the rules are followed. You can't just say, well, they were small and they didn't know how to do it. It's going to come back on you. Okay, so knowing that, it's really important that you have clarity about when you're going to give money to another organization. Are you giving them a subrecipient award or are you engaging in a contract, a vendor contract? Because it's only the federal awards that are subject to all these uniform guidance rules. So it's only your subrecipients that you're going to be held responsible for. Did they comply with the federal rules? When it comes to the contractors, there's plenty of rules for them too. And you can read in the FARS, the Federal Acquisition Regulation System, you can read about the rules with contractors, but they don't have the same extensive requirement to comply with the uniform guidance. So it's a little easier. And we're not going to go through all the details on this chart, but you are going to have copies of these slides. And one of the things that I've encouraged community action agencies that do have agreements with other nonprofits where they're passing through portions of their federal awards, I encourage them to go down this checklist and be sure they know whether it's a subrecipient agreement or a contractor agreement and that they know the rules they're supposed to be following. And this is what's hard. And I was an executive director of an organization that got a large federal grant, and part of what we were trying to do was help small immigrant community-based organizations develop capacity to serve their communities. That was a purpose of the grant. You can tell this is pre-We Hate DEI. So we were trying to do that. And so the groups that we wanted to award funds to were often very, very much in a startup stage. And so, we learned that the nature of the agreement we were going to have with them was going to be a subrecipient agreement because we were going to require them to carry out the purposes of the grant. And we learned that we had to do a risk assessment before we entered into an agreement with them, meaning we would go out and look at their accounting system, talk to the people who were going to do it, see whether we thought they could meet the federal requirements. We knew that in the agreement, we had to tell them that it was a subrecipient agreement and that they're the ALN number. And then we knew that if what we saw, we thought there were risks in our assessment, then we had to figure out how we were going to control those risks. What were we going to do to make sure that we got compliance on the money we gave them? And then finally, there in number four, okay, we figured out all these ways we thought to make it safe for us to give them the money, but we're required, the federal requirement is that you go out and you monitor to see whether it's working or not. So just coming up with some sort of, nice system doesn't meet the requirement. You have to monitor and make sure it's working. Okay. So, maybe that's almost enough about subrecipient agreements. I kind of emphasize them because I think a lot of community action agencies end up making them without really understanding the rules. So, this is just a little bit more about those rules. And I'm about to change gears. And so, if anybody is like already had enough and feels like, can't we, are there some loose ends about what I've said so far? Now would be a good time before we follow that bouncing ball into the knotty topic of procurement. Now, these requirements were really, I think, created with like giant universities in mind or state governments, very large entities that have very big staffs. And those staffs include a procurement office where maybe we've got several different people who know all these rules and make sure they're all followed. But in most community action agencies, there's no money for a procurement office or even a procurement officer. It typically lands on the fiscal director's head to function as the procurement officer. And so they're the ones that are going to have to make sure that all this happens. So the starting point now, since we got the uniform guidance and they did clarification on this in 2020, the starting point is you have to have written procurement policies and procedures. The policies and procedures have to address the topic of conflict of interest. They're very specific what you have to say about conflict of interest. So I just encourage people to read that section to 200.318 and pretty much copy out of it what your conflict of interest policy is going to cover. Because where they're really interested is which kind of people are there that we should watch out for because they might have a conflict of interest. Okay, we've got a policy that's compliant. We took it right out of the uniform guidance, and now we have to work on record keeping because when you look at the findings that people get on procurement, they're usually not about your policy wasn't compliant. They're usually about, and not even they're about you made bad decisions, you spent too much money, you chose the wrong vendors. That's not really what the findings are about. The findings are about you didn't keep the right records. And you weren't able to show us the records that documented that you did it right. So, what do you have to document? Well, what method of procurement? And remember, procurement is just buying something, buying services or buying materials. What method of procurement did we use to buy this thing? And we're going to go over what the methods are. There's a choice of methods. What method did we use? Then, what type of contract did we use if we used a contract at all? Now, in small purchases, we don't have a contract. We're not going to go to Office Depot and say, here's my contract to buy some typing paper from you. This is in larger procurements that you would be using a contract, and it has to be a contract that includes all the required elements. How did we select the contractors that we do business with? And again, there is some common sense in these rules that basically says if this is a small dollar item, let's not have a big process to select who we're going to buy it from. That's not cost effective. But if it's a larger dollar item, we do have to have some kind of process and we have to have documentation of what was the process and what was the basis for our decision. How did we decide which vendor to select and which vendor to reject? And we'll go over that there's thresholds of expense that triggers these requirements. And again, in the larger ones, not the small ones, we're not talking about buying, ink for the printer. We're talking about larger purchases. We have to document what was the basis for the price that we put in the contract. How did we figure out what to pay these people? So that's the basic thing. And what it's all about is fairness. That's what they're trying to get to is, did you really have fair and open competition? Did you consider vendors that might be able to provide the services or materials you want? And did you have a fair reason for choosing one over the other? Now, that second bullet again is talking about larger procurements where you would actually have specifications. This is used in construction projects a lot. And, there is a very important rule, and it's a rule that I find some community action agencies don't really know. And that is if you're going to do a construction project or a very other very large procurement, and sometimes like we're going to redo all our technology and have someone come in and do everything from soup to nuts, and we're actually going to send out a request for proposals for vendors who could do that for us. Well, a lot of us would say, nobody on our staff knows enough about technology or knows enough about construction to really be able to write a good set of specifications. So someone says, well, why don't we get my friend to help write those specifications? Well, that's where the issue begins because we've got to be sure that that friend is not part of a business entity that's going to propose to sell this to us, because that would not be fair if they helped write the specifications. And a lot of us do use this pre-qualified contractor provision so that we don't have to go through a lot of red tape when we just need to buy something. And that's pretty common in weatherization. So I suspect you may have developed a pre-qualified vendor list. Now, the area where there's a lot of controversy, a lot of problems, is that last bullet point, non-competitive procurement. Or we used to call that sole source. And this means I only considered one vendor. I didn't consider multiple vendors. There are very specific rules on that, which you can understand because that would not be fair. That would not be seeking a range of proposals. Okay, so they raised the thresholds in 2024. And a threshold means what size purchase do I follow? What rules? And so the micro purchase is something under $15,000. The small purchase is something between $15,000 and $350,000. Now, I have to say that many community action agencies just laugh when they see that. And they say, in my agency, we don't think $350,000 is small. That is not small to us. Now, remember, you can have your thresholds be lower. They just can't be higher. But the problem is, if you choose lower thresholds, that's what you're going to be evaluated on. So you have to be sure you train the staff to understand we have lower thresholds. They are not the ones you hear about in uniform guidance training. Sealed bids is a method of purchasing that's used primarily in construction. If you're going to do construction, you're going to need to use sealed bids for anything that's going to cost more than $350,000. Non-competitive proposal rules, those can go to smaller purchases too. You have to be sure you have justified why you only considered one vendor. Now, these thresholds, the 15,000, the 350,000, okay, they are now indexed, meaning they increase with inflation. So before you start using them, you need to go look in the FAR and be sure you have the current thresholds. And actually, I got tired of revising procurement policies. This year I said it was 350,000, and next year I learned, well, they've raised it to 357,000. So I just started wording the policy to be whatever it says in the FAR. And then we're always in sync with the FAR, if that's what you want to do. But you might not want to do that. You might not want to be in sync with the FAR. Okay, there are some exceptions to the federal procurement thresholds. But just to get the very quick picture. Those small purchases, those are the ones that they're willing to let go up to $350,000 in a single purchase. You got to get price or rate quotes from a reasonable number. Now, this is not an elaborate process. You can go on the internet and take screenshots of what different companies say they're selling something for. You can make phone calls and document the phone calls of what the vendor told you. This is not a big deal. The big deal is two things. One, keeping a record of what you did. And two, being sure that the person charged with doing this, when they got all done, looking at all these things on the internet or making phone calls to get quotes, that at the end of it, they write an explanation for, I reviewed the prices at these three or six places, and I chose place number one because, and it does not have to be because it was the lowest price. It could be because they have a very good reputation. We've had very good experiences with them, and the other vendors we consulted do not have such good service reputations. That's a legitimate reason, but you have to document the reason you made the decision you did. Now, so the new structure in 24 became there's the informal methods, that's the micro and the small purchases, and then there are the formal methods. And that's these three more than $350,000 purchases. It's going to be construction, you're going to use sealed bids. If it's going to be services, typically those are done through competitive proposals. Now, you can use these methods for thresholds under $350,000. But you got to use them if you're going to get to 350. And that's about what I'm going to say about procurement. And maybe I'll suggest that we hold procurement questions to the end because it's kind of endless what procurement questions are. And really, the thing that works best is just to open up the uniform guidance and read the section and then compare what you have in your policy to what they're saying there. Now I'm on to the part of this that is most interesting to me because, I guess having been an executive director and a program manager, I'm always interested in what can we buy with this money we just got? How am I sure that the things I want to spend this money on are going to be considered to be allowable, and I'm not going to get a finding that says I spent money on something that wasn't allowable. So that's what we're going to talk about. And at the end of what we're talking about today, we're going to talk about the challenge that some of the costs that we incur benefit multiple programs that we have or multiple grants that we have. And the challenge there is not proving that we made a reasonable decision to buy something allowable. The challenge there is figuring out how to allocate the cost among the different programs or funding sources. So that's a little preview of where we're going. Okay, so you can look it up in the uniform guidance, and they finally alphabetized these things in the definition section. So it's much easier than it used to be. I'm thinking about buying tables and chairs for a Head Start classroom. I can look up the definition of furniture and see what it is. So I find it very helpful. And you can figure out whether things are allowable, whether the cost is allowable. And there are some costs that are always allowable and some costs that are never allowable and some that are maybe type allowability. But here's what the subpart E, the cost principles, have to say about allowable costs. In order for a cost to be allowable to be charged to a federal award, and that language charged just means you can spend the federal award on this item. So first, you have to have evidence that you actually got the thing. You didn't just think about buying it, you actually bought it, or if it's like paying someone to do a service, they actually did the service. So we have to have evidence that it actually happened. We have to have evidence that the purchase was necessary. And that is usually handled by having a program manager or someone within a program who knows what the program requirements are. Put a note on an authorization to purchase something saying this is necessary to achieve our Head Start outcomes. That's all they need to say. They don't need to go through a long thing unless it's a large item that somebody would be like, I'm not sure that's necessary. Use some common sense. Is food necessary in Head Start? Yeah, we don't have to have a big justification for that. But is the latest AI technology for rocket ships necessary in Head Start? Probably not. So if we're going to buy that sort of thing, we're going to have a note to explain why that was necessary. And of course, it has to be true that the expense is not prohibited. And what is the one expense that you can pretty much count on being prohibited in all federal funds? Well, alcohol. You cannot purchase alcohol with your federal dollars. So the system is pretty straightforward until you get to the last point, the so-called allocability. And I always feel like that term came from Mary Poppins. It can't come from federal regulations, but this is this concept that we have a lot of costs that we incur that benefit more than one program or more than one grant. And we have to have a way of documenting that I did a fair allocation of that cost. I allocated it fairly so that I shared it out among the programs or the awards that benefited, and each one got their fair share. So, you know, this is what we just said. I, you know, cannot resist down on that third bullet saying, yeah, there were some changes in the uniform guidance that kind of let us calm down a little bit about what we used to call personal activity reports. We don't have to be quite that detailed anymore, but we do have to have personnel time records. And this is particularly important if we have staff that are doing things that benefit more than one program or more than one award. What's an example of that? Well, how about a community action agency that hires a bus driver? And in the morning, the bus driver drives for Head Start, and in the afternoon, they drive for the senior program. Okay, we're paying that person one paycheck, but we know that we have to allocate the cost of employing them between those two programs or two grant awards. And to do that, we have to require the person to maintain a timesheet and tell us how they spent their time. Now, maybe the plan is that this person is supposed to drive in the morning for Head Start and drive in the afternoon for seniors. But, you know, the plan isn't always what happens. And so we want the person to give us a record of what did happen. Today, Head Start went on a field trip, and so I drove 6 hours for Head Start and 2 hours for the seniors. So you get them, the person doing the work, to create the time record. Their supervisor signs off saying, yes, this looks like what they did. And with that information, we can allocate the cost of employing them between the two or six or 20 different programs that it benefited to have them working. So that's the concept. Now, some of you know that in 2014 and then in 2020, they made it clear that do you have to have this allocation, you know, think about the bus driver, the distribution of his wages between Head Start and the senior program. Do you have to have that documented before you cut the payroll checks? And the answer is no. You can use an estimate and then you can go back and look at the real record and adjust if necessary. Okay. So we already said this, it could be allowable or prohibited or possibly allowable. And things like capital expenditures are on that possible list. And these are the things that you usually have to get the prior approval. If you didn't get the prior approval, it's not allowable. The other thing that you have to keep in mind on allowability is actually timing is everything. You have to have the cost occur in the right time period that the grant is for. And so it means that we have to have gotten the benefit. So if I'm hiring a training consultant to come in and do training with my staff, I had it, the training I'm going to charge to the award that ends September 30th has to have happened by September 30th. I can't say, well, you know, I signed the contract with them in September, but they couldn't do the training till October. No, that would make it an October cost. So when you got the benefit is when it is allowable. And the same thing, you know, this comes up, get to the end of our fiscal year, get to the end of a grant award year. Maybe we have a little extra money left. And we think, well, maybe we could buy some supplies that we could carry into next year and fit and use up our money because we want to spend all of our money this year. Well, there's a rule for that. Of course, there's a rule for that. And the rule is if you make the purchase in this grant period, and if you at least begin getting use out of the purchase, in other words, it arrived and you started using those supplies, the fact that some of them might be still available after the end of the grant period, that's not going to disqualify the expense. But if you just place the order and it doesn't come till after the end of the grant period, so you couldn't use any of it, that's not going to qualify as an allowable expense. That's a technical area. It's really annoying. So it's always good to go back and read the uniform guidance on that. But honestly, this is where the problems come in. This is where we really have trouble. is the reality that not all costs that we incur can be associated with just one program or just one grant. Now, the feds use this term cost objective, and they say you choose how to define cost objective for your organization. You could define it as programs, you could define it as projects, or as different funding awards. It's your choice, but you have to be consistent in how you use the term cost objective. And so some costs that you're going to incur are going to benefit more than one cost center or cost objective. Those of us who are accountants, we in accounting school, you learn about cost centers, and that's essentially what a cost objective is. It's a bucket where you're going to put costs for a particular purpose. If you do have a cost that benefits multiple cost objectives, you have to divide it up. What's an example of that? Well, how about a facility? We have one big facility and we put all of our programs in that facility, as well as all our administrative personnel. Well, they each benefit from being inside and having heat and light and having the place clean. So we have to come up with a method to share out the cost of that facility. Now, those of us who have a negotiated federal indirect cost rate may say, well, that is too much trouble. I am just going to put that facility's cost into the indirect cost rate and deal with it that way. But if we're not using that method, we're going to have to figure out what's a fair way to divide up that facility's costs. The rule is the method you choose has to both be reasonable. It makes sense. It's not like we had space aliens come and tell us how to do it. It makes sense, but it also has to be cost effective. You can't come up with something that is so elaborate that you would spend an unreasonable amount of money and time to use the method. And whatever method you choose, you got to apply it consistently. So, this is just the basic rules of allocability. And this is the same thing again. We're just saying the same thing again in slightly different ways. And really, this is what we're looking at. When you think of all the different types of costs that you have, and I'm not talking about, well, there's salaries, supplies, transport, those are line item costs. I'm talking about the behavior of the costs. Some of the costs we have can be directly associated with a single program or a single grant. What's my example? I hire a Head Start teacher. That's all the person does is they teach Head Start for 3-year-olds in a classroom. And that's what their timesheet says. Well, there is no doubt that is a direct cost of the Head Start award, or if we are looking maybe at our early childhood program using program rather than award, that's a direct cost. When we go to these other costs, the ones with the blue heading, indirect or shared, this is where we have language problems because the term indirect in the federal system has so many specific meanings that it's really hard to talk clearly about it. I would say these are shared costs. They benefit more than one cost center, and the challenge is to figure out how to divide them up among those cost centers. Well, we think on it and then we write a cost allocation policy. And this really describes how you do it. First describes how did I, what's a direct cost in my system? What are these shared costs in my system? And how are we going to allocate the shared cost? And we now have to have a written cost allocation policy to be compliant with the uniform guidance. And this says, this is where we get into the sticky stuff because most people can understand the concept of a shared cost, like my bus driver. Yeah, obviously, part of his time benefited Head Start and part seniors. Where people get all tangled up is with administrative costs. And that's because there's so much attention to these costs. And people have been kind of, I don't know, I would say badgered into trying to make these costs be as low as possible. And some of the federal statutes actually put caps on how large these costs can be. So it confuses our thinking, I think, because of that pressure. But there really is a definition of what is an administrative cost. And we're going to look at that. We're going to look at how we define, and first we're going to define agency-wide administrative costs. And think about it. In a community action agency, we have one board of directors. So somebody is supporting the work of that board. We have one accounting system for the whole agency, and we produce a set of financial statements, and we have the whole thing audited. So that whole finance function is going to benefit all the different cost centers in the agency, and the board is benefiting all the cost centers in that all of them need to have a governing board. So that's going to be agency-wide administrative costs that we're talking about. And the real issue is, well, how do we divide that up fairly? So we're going to have this cost allocation policy, and we're going to have a cost allocation plan that really spells it out. How are we going to do it? And you have to formally adopt this plan, and actually your executive director needs to certify this is the plan we adopted and this is the plan we're going to use, so that anybody who comes in to check on you can see that you had a written plan and you followed it. Now, it sounds simple, but it really isn't, because you've got to make some decisions about which costs you're going to allocate. And you could talk about them as being in the indirect cost pool. I would say they're shared costs. And so, you know, what are you putting in that? Is it just the agency-wide administration? Or did you decide to put some other costs in there just to make it simpler? Like some people would say, well, yeah, there's all these staff performing administrative functions, but it's also all our general supplies, because we don't want to count them out program by program. So you got to define what's going in there. And then you've got to clarify whether you're putting anything that isn't actually defined as administrative into that indirect pool, because it's going to make a difference. You can do it if you want to, but you're going to have to be aware that you're doing it. Now, you know, we've got this cost allocation plan that we created. And when the uniform guidance first came out in 2014, there was this imaginary idea that maybe state agencies, pass-through entities, would approve these cost allocation plans. Well, I haven't found a state yet that will do that, but maybe you have. Sometimes you will find a local government. Generally, it's up to you. You have to develop the plan and, you know, do your best. I usually talk with my independent auditor to say, this is my cost allocation plan. Do you see any problems? You know, of course, the independent auditor wants to be adamant that they didn't tell you how to run your business, that, you know, that's your job as management. But usually they'll offer an opinion. Okay, now, are they going to really look at it during the audit? Are they really going to examine your cost allocation plan and decide, is it compliant with these regs and did you follow it? Well, in my experience, some do and some don't. Who's really going to look at it are the monitors from your different funding sources when they turn up to do a monitoring. And the same thing is true of them. Some of them don't even want to touch it. Others become obsessed with these cost allocation plans and really want to argue with you about the plan that you chose. So I'm a kind of cautious person, so I try to get a good written plan. And this is what's going to be in it. You know, I'm going to explain, how do I define direct cost? How do I define shared cost? What am I using as cost objective? Is it programs or is it grants or is it some other cost center structure? What types of shared costs are we going to have to allocate, and what methods are we going to use them? Because we can choose different methods to allocate different types of costs. How do I define agency-wide administrative costs? What did I put in that category? What method did I choose to allocate those agency-wide administrative costs? And really important thing, what dates is this plan effective for? Because the system expects that you're going to review it every year, and you're going to maybe, you know, put a little note on the bottom where the executive director says this plan has been approved to extend the plan through fiscal year 26-27. We want a beginning and an end date on the plan. And we're going to have exhibits to support the plan, to explain it by showing samples. And I think I'm going to have an example come up here. I just want to mention before we get too far away from this topic that it's not just the uniform guidance that impacts us. As community action agencies, as recipients of CSBG, we have to meet the organizational standards. And there is an organizational standard that says we have to create an organization-wide budget for each of our fiscal years, and that budget is supposed to include all the sources and all the uses of funds that we're going to have during the year. And this turns out to be a really critical document when we're trying to illustrate how our cost allocation plan works. So now I visit a lot of community action agencies, and I know that it is very common to see the annual budget as one column of numbers. Here's a list of some revenue sources. Here's a list of some expense categories, supplies, personnel, transportation. I don't think that's a compliant budget because it doesn't really tell us which programs are being supported by which funding sources and which funding sources are incurring which expenses. So I think we'll be happier if we use a matrix format for our annual budget and use that to support our cost allocation plan. So now I seem to be a little bit stuck here. So let's see if I can get it unstuck. Now, even doing that, it doesn't solve all the problems because we all know that we have multiple grant agreements and they don't all come with the same period. They do not all match our fiscal year. So preparing this budget is challenging. That's a whole other workshop. But just to acknowledge that when we're talking about a fiscal year budget, we're talking about a budget where you're showing what income is going to be available to us during this fiscal year and what expenses are we going to have during this fiscal year. And yes, you have detailed grant budgets, and they may be for different time periods. It might be a 2-year grant. It might be for a time period that began 6 months before your fiscal year began. You have to have that. But when it comes time to do the annual budget, we've got to get it to fit into a 12-month frame. So this is, what I'm talking about, an organizational-wide budget structure. And this particular group chose to use program as their cost objective. And you'll see what they've done in this format. They've got a total column. And we're only showing three programs. I know you have more than three programs, but they have an energy services program where they might have put their LIHEAP and a bunch of other energy related programs, grants that are funding their energy services. They got an early childhood program, and that probably has their primary Head Start grant, their early Head Start grant, their home-based Head Start grant, their state look-alike Head Start grant, and it might even have wraparound childcare funding in it. So it's a program that has multiple grants. And then emergency services, a lot of us have homeless service centers, right? Where people come in and we help them find housing, we help them get services, we help them get new IDs. And we probably, many people have 20 different grant awards funding that emergency service center. So behind this picture is a lot of detail about all those distinct grants, but we've pulled it together to give the big picture of what we're doing. And you'll notice that as we get over to the right side, we've got a column for fund development because, most of our federal sources aren't going to pay for fundraising. And we've got a column I called shared costs. And those are the ones that are not administrative. They're things like facilities and, IT, our website. They're things that benefit every cost center, but they're not administrative. And so there we go with the final column, management. That is agency-wide administration. And this example is kind of odd because it puts the expenses on top and the revenues down below. But what I really wanted you to notice that I did in this is if you look at that green line, it says direct expenses, and those are all the expenses in each of those programs and in fundraising and in the shared cost and in the management. We start there. Those are the easy costs because we can directly associate them. And then we allocate the shared cost, give everybody a share of whatever it is, utilities, supplies. We give them a share each program. And after we do that, we allocate the management, the agency-wide management, so that we get to the total expenses. And what we hope is true is that yellow line that says total expenses, that we've got enough money in the grants that are funding each of these programs to cover the total expenses. That's what we're trying for. It doesn't always work out that way. Why is that? Well, some of our grants probably have administrative caps. And so when they would look at that allocated management line, that they would say that's above our cap. We'll only pay the portion that fits the cap. So this is I think it's a very helpful format for illustrating how you're doing cost allocation and illustrating which grants are funding which programs. But it doesn't always have a perfect answer. And I'm going to just stop there and say this is helpful when we get on to the next piece of what we're going to do. There's another version of this that is by funding award, and that's totally fine too. That's an allowable cost objective. That's that definition of cost objective. And these two slides that I'm going to show now are just trying to illustrate that it's your choice. You could do what I did in that sample budget where I used function or program. I said the whole energy services program, the whole emergency services program. That's one way to define cost objective. Another way is by award. Now, when you do this by award, you better have a column for unrestricted because we pretty much all know that we are not going to be able to cover all of our costs through these various federal awards and even our state awards and even foundation awards. They just aren't, it's not going to cover everything. And we probably do have to have some kind of unrestricted money that we have access to. Okay, so this is we've talked about this, and I'm rushing a little bit because I want to be sure we get to the really key piece that will set us up for next week. Okay, so these shared or indirect costs, and why I hesitate about calling them indirect is for people who are familiar with the negotiation of indirect cost rates. That term indirect has a very specific meaning, and they just kind of go nuts when they see it used improperly. So shared is a more descriptive term, and it doesn't quite trigger that response to that term. So these are costs that benefit multiple objectives. They include the agency-wide administrative costs, but that isn't all that has to be in there. And the key thing about all these costs is it is impossible to determine the exact benefit provided to each cost objective. Your finance department function. We've got a CFO, we've got a controller, we've got some sort of payroll specialist and an accounts payable specialist and maybe a receivable specialist. And they're all working together. And particularly the controller and the CFO, they're working on the general ledger. They're working to get a trial balance that they can turn into financial statements and submit reports to the board and prepare reports for funders and have ready for independent audit. Okay, now if we tell the CFO and the controller, now, I know you're kind of busy, but could you sort of think about every, 6 minutes or so, what are you really working on? When you're proofing the trial balance and reconciling the various accounts in the trial balance, are you really thinking more about Head Start, or were you thinking more about energy? Or were you really thinking about homeless services? And that's ridiculous. That's not how accounting is done. We do general ledger accounting as a whole process. So the idea that we could somehow be exacting about exactly how much benefit went to each of the cost objectives is pretty much considered an unrealistic idea. And if you thought of a system to do it, it probably would be not cost effective. So what we do is we get these estimating methods. And but I guess it would help to first define what are we talking about with agency-wide admin costs. And first one is executive oversight. Now, that doesn't mean this is just anything done by somebody called executive director. That's not what executive oversight is. It is the time that someone spends thinking about reviewing, planning for the entire operation. And things like, my HR director comes with proposed revisions to the employment policy. As executive director, I'm going to review that and think about it, maybe get some legal advice. That's executive oversight that I'm performing. Board support, executive directors do this, and they often have an assistant who helps. This is how we keep our board engaged. We get materials for them, we make sure the minutes are taken, we cultivate them so they attend regularly. So that's board support. Financial management, critical function, and it's everything that it takes to maintain compliance with the uniform guidance and to produce financial statements. When we come to HR management and IT management, we're not talking about somebody touches a computer, so they're in IT management. We're talking about, do you have a position where someone has a high level of skill and they're doing IT planning to identify the future needs for technology, and they're doing high level management selection of products? We're not a help desk. That's not what we're talking about. So, and the same thing with HR. We're not saying this is the person who, sends reminders that you didn't turn in your timesheet, or you ask them how much vacation accrual you have. That's a clerical function. We're talking about somebody at a high level who is able to do planning, benefits negotiation, revision of the policies. So that's what we typically mean in agency-wide admin. Now, if I were talking to a group of people who all had negotiated indirect cost rates, they probably would have included more costs. They would have taken that IT clerk or that HR clerk. They would have pushed them all in here because it would have been simpler. But if we are dealing with a system where we're being pressured about, are you spending too much on admin? We're going to take a very narrow approach to what is agency-wide admin. I just listed some work that people did, like the director of finance, okay? So it's not just the person and their salary and the taxes and benefits that go along with their salary. It's because we let them work inside, we allocate a share of the facilities and we give them supplies and we let them use a computer, and we give them access to IT help. All that is associated with them, and we're going to allocate those costs to get what share belongs to our finance function. That's another example of allocating shared cost and letting that contribute to the allocated agency-wide admin costs. Same thing is true. We hire an independent auditor. That auditing is an administrative function, so we're going to put that in our administrative cost center. Now, here's the thing that the 2020 revision really clarified. And those of you with Head Start probably have known this for a long time. And that is that there are some administrative costs that are directly associated with a single program. They don't benefit the whole agency, they only benefit that program. It's still an administrative cost. A common example is we've got an accounting clerk that we assign to the Head Start program. And all they do is work on accounting relating to Head Start. They never touch the general ledger. They never participate in agency-wide financial management. They're just doing Head Start accounting work. Because it's accounting, that makes it an administrative cost. But because it only benefits one cost objective, it makes it a direct cost. So we can have both an allocation of agency-wide administrative costs and some direct administrative costs. And they're still all administrative costs when somebody tells us there's a limit on how much we can charge for administrative costs. Now we're getting to the end of our time today and what we're really going to focus on in part two of this. And that is this reality that the uniform guidance says there are four different ways that recipients and subrecipients can charge for their agency-wide admin and other indirect cost or shared costs. And those four ways, three of them are very similar. Those are all in the yellow or gold, and there's some kind of indirect cost rate. And they have differences among these different rates, but they all operate with the same basic mechanism for computing a rate and then applying that rate. And the green box is very, very different from that. That is a method of allocating costs and then directly charging them. What's the difference that you would observe if you were looking at a federal funds report for an organization, somebody sending in their report for this quarter's expenses? Well, if they're using one of the three gold methods, there's going to be a line where they put something down for indirect costs. There's going to be an entry on that line. If they're using the green method, direct charging for allocated costs, there's going to be nothing on that indirect cost line because they are not using an indirect cost rate and they're not entitled to put anything on that line if they're not using an indirect cost rate. So that's really the big difference we're dealing with here. And w next time we're going to go through a much more discussion of these four methods. Remember, this slide said four, but this slide says two because there really are two categories, the gold category and the green category. And the indirect cost rate method involves a fraction, and there's a lot of choices about what you put in the numerator and what you put in the denominator. We'll talk about that next time. The yellow, or the, I think it was a green, the green box is the direct charge method. And this is the method where we come up with a cost allocation methodology and we apply it to these agency-wide administrative costs. And then oddly, we report them as direct costs. And that always puzzled me as an executive director, but we'll talk about why that's true. Just for like homework for next time, take a look at this chart because this really will help you sort of visualize what the difference is between these methods. And really, this is where I see community action agencies starting to think maybe we were using the cost allocation direct charging method on the, I think that's the left. Now we want to consider the de minimis rate, which will push us into the indirect cost rate methodology. And I'm going to skip over this and just, kind of take us, we'll deal with that next time and say that our next time together is part two, which is on June 10th. And we're going to pick up right where we left off, thinking about those three gold ways to do it and the one green way to do it. And the goal of that session really is thinking about what would be best for your organization. And if you end up thinking, maybe we should consider going to the de minimis rate, we'll talk about how you would actually make that change. So this is what's going to be on the agenda. We are going to talk about indirect cost rates. We're going to go in some depth to the de minimis rate, talk about the pros and cons, and then dealing with admin caps, where like in Head Start, it's 15%, and you've got a cap in LIHEAP, and you have many other caps, and what to do about it. We'll talk about that. So we are out of time, and I sort of crowded out any questions. So, Courtney, did you see any questions coming in the chat?
I do not see any questions.
Well, that might be that we've just made people so depressed they don't want to ask a question, but hopefully it's not that. It's hopefully that they're thinking. And remember, I'm very happy. You can email me. I have my website address on the bottom of these slides. And if you go to my website, you can email me through the website. And I'm very happy to answer questions. And it's actually kind of interesting to me what questions people ask. That will really help me as I'm preparing for next week. So I think we did it, Courtney. What do you think?
Yes. Thank you so much, Kay.
Okay, and thank you all for making this time work for me too. I hope it wasn't too miserable for you. Okay, well, I'll see you in next week.
Thank you, everyone. See you next week. Have a
Okay,
good day.